A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Thanks for listening and being part of my podcast. I hope 2024 is kind to you. In my 27 years as a Victorian policewoman, I investigated everything from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. Policing taught me a lot about human nature, which I explore in my podcasts with a mixture of interesting and thought-provoking guests discussing the human side and impact of crime on all those involved, including the investigators. And I'd love for you to give me a review if you can. They're just a great help to me. I give my guests the opportunity to tell their story in their own words and how they remember an incident. It may not be how others remember it, which I ask you to please keep in mind. My podcasts are not suitable for children and some adults for that matter. If you find yourself affected by my subject matter, contact Lifeline or any other support service or person you feel comfortable with. Thank you.
Social media has been a huge leap forward in the accessibility of information about courts, from courts, about what courts do to the public.
I came across an article in The Guardian by Donna Liu, published in May 2023, titled Kathleen Folbig. Science sheds new light on case of mother convicted of murdering her children, unquote. And the article caught my eye, as did an opinion in that article by Dr. Leah Williams, a lecturer in criminology and criminal law at the University of New South Wales, and who happens to be my guest today. The sentence I refer to from Dr. Williams reads, quote, "There's an entrenched traditional notion of what femininity is that I think can disadvantage women who come into contact with the criminal justice process. It's something that you really saw with the Lindy Chamberlain case. She didn't cry enough, or she didn't seem sad enough. All the judgments made about character then feed into perceptions of criminal guilt," unquote. Dr. Williams says that Kathleen Folbig was similarly demonised. Kathleen Folbig was convicted for the deaths of her four young children, who were all babies, in New South Wales over a 10-year period. And in 2003, she was convicted of the murder of three of them and the manslaughter of one child. Always maintaining her innocence, she was initially sentenced to 40 years in prison, reduced to 30 years on appeal. However, after 2 decades in jail, she was pardoned, and in December 2023, she had her convictions quashed following a judicial inquiry that found there was reasonable doubt with regard to her guilt. That finding was informed by new scientific evidence that had been unavailable at the time of her trial and other crucial evidence relating to Folbig's diaries, which were presented by the prosecution as akin to confessions. And look, we'll chat about that a little bit later. But what I'm more interested in is how Dr. Williams feels about the way that the media cover criminal processes, such as Kathleen Folbig's trials, how they portray criminals, and the influence and danger that they can have in swaying public opinion. Dr. Leah Williams is a lecturer in the School of Law, Society and Criminology in the Faculty of Law and Justice at the University of New South Wales. She teaches criminal law courses across the law and criminology programs and has an interest in legal education, criminalisation and the representation of crime and criminal justice processes in the media. Her doctoral research examined the ways in which gender norms are reinforced and amplified through the reporting of criminal trials and the relationship between those gender norms and notions of deviance. Her research is inspired by a fascination with the way in which criminal law and criminal justice processes are communicated to and understood by the public, and the differences in social and legal definitions of justice. I think we could be here for a very long time because both Dr. Williams and I have a lot in common. But welcome, Dr. Williams. Can I call you Leah?
Yes, please do. Hello, Narelle. Thank you so much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure, Leah. So you've obviously got an interest in law, social justice, etc. Is there a specific reason that you've concentrated your research on the media and the power and or influence, I suppose, it has in reporting crime-related matters?
I really have always had a bit of an interest in the way the media represents crime. So whether it's the way that crime dramas are put together or true crime documentaries or podcasts or other kind of media are presented. But I think I became really interested in this as an academic topic towards the end of my undergraduate degrees when there were a number of high-profile cases that were attracting quite a bit of media attention. And I noticed some differences, I guess, in the way that a lawyer would understand those cases compared to the way that they were being reported to the public and then understood and reacted to by the public and by politicians. So one of those key cases was the Kieran Loveridge case. Kieran Loveridge was eventually convicted over the killing of Thomas Kelly. And this was the case in conjunction with a number of other cases that set off a number of reforms in New South Wales, colloquially known as the One Punch Reforms. So it was a really important case on a number of fronts. And one of the reasons it was a kind of atypical case was initially the reporting on the case was unusual in the sense that this was a case that had a number of the factors that would normally make for a really high-profile kind of scandalous case, but it was reported in a quite measured way. There was, and the political response was also reasonably measured and quite holistic in the sense that we had criminal justice reforms, but also some reforms around public transport and reforms around licensing and, you know, there was a multi-dimensional kind of response to it. But when it came to the criminal proceedings, when Kieran Loveridge eventually came to court after being charged with murder, he turned up and pleaded guilty to manslaughter. And there was some, I think, public outcry about this, partly because there was an expectation that perhaps he'd been charged with murder. This was a really serious case. This was a case that had really affected the community. And there was an expectation that he was going to be convicted for that very serious offence of murder, which also carries with it some really, I suppose, moral connotations of what we understand someone's criminal culpability to be. When we hear someone is a murderer, that's slightly different than hearing someone's been convicted of manslaughter. So he pleaded guilty to manslaughter. He received what was considered to be a pretty lenient sentence. And there's a range of reasons why Kieran Loveridge received a lower sentence than may have been expected, partly his age, partly his quite disadvantaged background, but that sentence was ultimately appealed by the prosecution and it was almost doubled on appeal, really in line with what ultimately ended up being the mandatory minimum sentence imposed for the one-punch homicide offence that was introduced. So this case highlighted to me a disparity, I suppose, in the way that lawyers understand justice and the way that the public understands and expects justice to be done through the criminal justice system. And I became really interested in the role that the media plays in trying to bridge those gaps, because we can't expect the public to have a legal understanding of criminal justice. And we also need to understand that the criminal justice system is there to a degree to reflect back to society our expectations of what justice should be. So I became really interested in that comparison or that contrast between the two in certain circumstances.
So, and I understand what you mean, because lawyers do have a very, very different understanding to the public, because lawyers have done, you know, courses, and they've done uni degrees and all this sort of thing. So I suppose we all get a bit, tied up in our own little worlds, and we think everyone knows what we know. But lawyers sometimes, I think, not just lawyers, I think a lot of people in the justice system, they don't relate well, I don't think, to the public. I think that sometimes they can use all these words and phrases, and I think sometimes that puts the public, it's at a disadvantage because they don't really understand what the lawyers are talking about or whatever.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I like the fact that you concentrate or that that fascinated you, because it fascinates me too. And just those words, like the word murder, in a heading in a newspaper, the word murder, for some reason it attracts us, like, well, me and probably a lot of others, a lot of true crime people, it attracts us, that word, and you just want to read about it. But manslaughter, you're right, it's nowhere near as dramatic, it's nowhere near as serious, is it?
And it doesn't have that connotation. If we pull up, if we think of the word murder or murderer, it really pulls up a particular image in your mind and a particular expectation of how the criminal justice system is going to deal with that person. Whereas manslaughter is, rightly, because of the nature of the offence, it's a very broad offence. It covers all sorts of circumstances in which somebody can kill someone else, ranging from something that is really just above being an accident to something that is just below murder. So it's such a broad concept that it doesn't carry that same visceral reaction that we have to the term murder.
Just on that, do you think that the criticism of judges and people in the justice system, do you think that's quantified? Do you think that it's got some merit?
I think it depends on the situation. So I tend to disagree with criticism that says judges are out of touch, because I think that judges see a lot more of society than what most of us see. Judges, day in, day out, are interacting in very precise detail with the horrible things that human beings can do to each other and the circumstances that lead people to engage in that conduct. So I believe that judges have quite a bit of insight into what causes people to come into contact with the criminal justice system, what factors influence the way that people behave with each other, despite the fact that judges are very well paid, very highly educated. And I think there's fair criticism to say that it's a not necessarily very diverse bunch of people. That diversity could certainly be improved. But I don't agree broadly with the criticism that judges are out of touch, because I do think that they see and experience a lot more of society than the majority of us, even if we tend to think that they kind of sit up on their benches with their wigs on, out of touch. I don't think that's the case.
Actually, that's a good point you raise, because I think to myself, as a policewoman, you start to think, and this may be the same with judges, but you start to think that the whole world is full of, let's say, pedophiles and sex offenders, because that's all you hear all day long. It's what you investigate. Every interview you do is all about these people, and you do start to, I suppose I'm trying to say that you do start to get a bit of a feel that the world is full of bad people, and I suppose you're right that they do see the absolute worst in humanity. And in that sense, I wonder how you could be out of touch, because you're probably more in touch than nearly anybody, because you're hearing those stories day in and day out. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm one of the, you know, every now and then I'll think they've got no idea, that judge, because I think the public want the sentence to be comparative, let's say the, a murder, and they might, you know, the offender or the person fronting court, maybe they do get a lenient sentence, but there'll be heaps of reasons why they get that. But the public are up in arms, oh, they should be in for 25 years and,
yeah, well, that's, you know, it
not
too.
Breathe the air. Yeah.
And I think sentencing in particular raises those criticisms because it quantifies the level of criminality. The judge has to put, particularly for those serious offences, the judge has to put a number on the amount of time that a person is going to spend in prison. And the calculations that they do to reach that number often involve a balancing of the individual circumstances of the offender and external circumstances related to the impact that that crime has had on society and the harm that has been caused. And there's a number of factors that need to be balanced. But the sentencing judgment is either not, in most cases, the sentencing judgment is not live streamed. It may be published, but it could be 20, 30, 50 pages long, and it's not necessarily put in a place that is accessible or is going to be noticed by the public in their day-to-day browsing on the internet. The courts in some circumstances have started putting out summaries of judgments or of sentencing remarks, but to fully understand something like a sentence, it's important to read and understand all the factors that were taken into account, and that's in most instances not going to be something that most people are going to do. And this is where the media comes in. The media is supposed to be the conduit between the courts and the public. They're supposed to make what the courts do accessible to the public, both in a actual access to the information sense, but also in a comprehensibility sense. You know, the media is not simply taking that sentencing judgment and putting it in the newspaper or up online. They are summarising it. They're pulling out parts that they think are most relevant for the public to know. And depending on the case, that can be done effectively or less effectively, or in a way that truly reflects what was said in the judgment or not. And that can depend on a number of factors as well.
Actually, I'm thinking with you saying that, a lot would depend actually on the reporter and the reporter's understanding of the legal process. I imagine, you know, the reporters, the court reporters, they're quite well versed in and educated, I suppose, in how a court works, but they can be influenced like anyone else can in certain cases and report what they believe is important for the public to hear. I imagine a lot would depend on, I don't know, maybe the age of the reporter, whether they're male or female, what they're reporting on, their life history. They can all be influencers, can't they?
Absolutely. And court reporting is a specialist round. It's generally not something that people dip in and out of. And if you consume court reports, you'll often see the same names of journalists over and over again, and you start to become familiar with them. Occasionally you have people who are not usually court reporters popping in, maybe they need to fill in, maybe there's a big case, maybe there's a number of big cases on and the media organisation just doesn't have enough court reporters to go around. But I think you're right. The experiences of the journalist really can't be separated from their interpretation of what's going on, but also then their story goes through the editorial process. So what they actually write might also be edited by sub-editors or editors having a headline put on that they didn't necessarily write. So it's a whole process. It's not a direct link necessarily between the journalist and the public either.
Social media's played a huge or has made a huge impact on our lives, in particular reporting news and newsworthy events almost instantaneously, which embraces, I suppose, open justice. However, sometimes that reporting can be inaccurate and prejudicial, which can affect, you know, procedural fairness for both the accused and the victim or survivor. So can you share with us some of your findings regarding the impact and dangers that this type of reporting can have within the community?
Social media has been a huge leap forward in the accessibility of information about courts, from courts, about what courts do to the public. And the courts have been a little bit slow to embrace it because the key concern of the courts is to protect the integrity of proceedings. And protecting the integrity of proceedings means making sure that those proceedings are fair, that there's not unfair prejudice to the defendant, that there's not any contamination of witnesses or any undue influence of the jury, if there is a jury in the case. Social media can have all of those negative impacts, but when journalists use social media, they tend to use it in a highly effective way. We've seen exceptions for court reporters being able to go into courtrooms and live tweet proceedings. And that has been a way to, in some cases, bypass some of those other editorial processes. Even if what is said in the tweets by journalists ultimately ends up in a way being stitched together and put into an article or a report that is then put out, it is a direct line from the journalist from the courtroom, which provides a level of...
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I suppose engagement that the public wouldn't otherwise have, being able to watch a tweet thread, and I'm using Twitter because I haven't retrained myself to use X, but but that watching that tweet thread from the journalist in real time coming out of the courtroom gives you that sense of being there. It gives you that sense of this is happening now rather than reading about it after the fact. And it also means they can include a bit more detail than what they might be able to include in a report where they've got a word limit or where they've got a deadline and they need to get something up online or file something by the end of the day. So for Open Justice, which is supposed to be about making courts accessible to the public, both physically, though most people don't have the time to actually go into a courtroom, but also in terms of comprehension. So journalists sitting in there and explaining what's going on, often providing direct quotes from witnesses or from the lawyers, from the judge about what's being said. That, I think, is a really useful development, and it's one that the courts are now much more comfortable with than what they were initially.
I think by bringing the public into the courtroom, because as you say, there's not a lot of people that do have that time. But personally, I think that can only be a good thing for the justice system to have people be able to listen at the time it is happening, like real time, live.
Yes. Oh,
I think it's such a powerful tool to show, what is going on in a courtroom and how bloody long some things can take. You know, they think, the public would think, what are they doing? Why can't they make a decision or whatever? But I just think it's a great initiative with social media. It's a great thing to be able to go in there and almost be part of it.
Yeah, and it really gives a lot more insight into the process than, say, the outcome.
Yeah.
Because the outcome is something that it's relatively easy to report, but that outcome is the product of a whole lot of legal argument and a whole lot of factual argument and a whole lot of evidence that's been presented and argued about. So the outcome needs that context, I think, in order for open justice to be really effective, because the point of open justice is to make sure that the criminal justice system is reflecting societal expectations of what it's there for and to allow public scrutiny of what's going on in the courtroom. But without understanding that process, I don't think that scrutiny and that evaluation of whether social expectations are being met can really be effectively undertaken.
I'm thinking of there are so many advantages for that reporter to be in there and reporting it, let's say live. Just thinking aloud, I wonder if there must be negatives for that. I'm just thinking aloud, I wonder what a negative would be of allowing the public into the courtroom through a reporter.
There are a couple. So one of them is if the reporters are essentially reporting in real time, if something comes up in court and there's application to have that particular fact suppressed, if it's already been tweeted out, then that suppression order is not going to be effective. So in some jurisdictions, they have introduced a kind of hold on reporting. There needs to be a 10-minute buffer between when something occurs in court and when it can be tweeted about.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah. Just in case something comes up that they don't want reported more broadly because maybe someone said something that's prejudicial or whatever it might be. So to allow applications for suppression. One of the other big concerns is contamination of witnesses. So witnesses who have not yet given evidence are supposed to not know what's going on in the courtroom. They're supposed to not have their evidence influenced at all by what's already been said. So there's some concern that if a witness's evidence is being live tweeted and there's a witness who's coming in after that witness gives evidence, that witness might be influenced in how they answer questions by what's been said by an earlier witness. And the final concern might be, and this is something that journalists wouldn't do because of the risk that it poses, but journalists are only allowed to report where it's a jury case. Journalists are only allowed to report what the jury sees to lessen the risk that jurors are going to base their decision on anything other than what they've seen in the trial. So if there is legal argument about, say, the admissibility of a particular piece of evidence, that argument takes place in the absence of the jury, and the journalists aren't allowed to report on that, what's called a voir dire, that legal argument about the admissibility of evidence, because the jury is not allowed to know that that evidence exists until it's determined to be admissible.
In our talks prior to today, we were talking about social media, and you said one of the points you made was about the apprehended bias of potential jurors. Can you take us through that?
So this is often an issue before a matter comes to trial, and it's about the way that matters are reported maybe just after a criminal event has occurred, or maybe around the time that somebody is arrested and charged. The risk of social media is not so much in the way that journalists use it, because journalists may completely legitimately report on a criminal event or the fact that somebody has been arrested and charged, but the way in which members of the public may then build on that reporting or go off from that reporting and start making other statements about who that person is, what they may have done in the past, if they have previous convictions, anything about their character, that then is widely and easily accessible by any other members of the public who may ultimately find themselves sitting on the jury for that person when they come to trial. So for journalists, once somebody has been arrested, we enter what's called the sub judice period, and that is a period during which restrictions come into place about what can be reported, and that generally relates to anything to do with the person. Our media in Australia is pretty good generally at taking a more conservative approach to what can be reported, partly because our contempt laws are a little bit uncertain. So everyone's a little bit worried about being done for contempt, but also for the sort of broader objective of protecting the integrity of the proceedings when they eventually make it to court. The public, while they can be charged with contempt, it's harder to track down somebody who's a user on social media. It's harder to, I suppose, quantify the potential impact that some random tweet has had on the opinions of jurors, and we don't question our jurors in New South Wales or in Australia in the way that you might see on American TV shows. So unless a juror discloses to their fellow jurors that they have come in knowing all about the trial and have a set opinion that the person is guilty, and the other jurors report that to the judge, it's impossible to really know what jurors know, what level of bias they might have. So it's best to try and avoid that where we can. Journalists are very good at that, but social media has made it a little bit harder to prevent that apprehended bias where the public is engaging in commentary about crimes and criminal matters and people who are accused of criminal acts.
You also talked about the frustration of suppression orders.
Yes.
Could you take us through that?
So a suppression order is an order that's made by a court. It can be a suppression order or what's known as the non-publication order. And it's essentially an order made by the court to try and protect either the identity of either an accused person or a particular witness, maybe the victim of a particular offence, or it may be an order made in relation to specific parts of the evidence that are being given in a trial, or it may be a suppression order over the entire trial itself, because the trial itself is so vulnerable to interference or to prejudice that the whole trial needs to be suppressed. And we saw that in relation to the Adrian Bailey case in Victoria, and also the George Pell case in Victoria as well. There was a suppression order put on the first of Cardinal George Pell's cases because there was an expectation on part of the prosecution that there would be a second trial. And there was a concern that if the fact of the first trial and the verdict of the first trial were reported, then the bias that would attach to the second trial would be such that Pell couldn't get a fair trial in the second trial. That suppression order over the Pell trial was one that we saw contempt charges arise from, because generally a suppression order means that you can't report on a matter and you also can't report on the existence of the suppression order. It's just a totally, just are supposed to go silent on the matter. But the Herald Sun, after the Pell verdict came in the first case, put up a front page that was totally blacked out and had the word censored across it, and basically said something really big has happened, but we can't tell you about it because the courts won't let us, which is a clear act of contempt, and led to a number of individual journalists and media organizations being charged with contempt. The individual journalists didn't end up being convicted, and there was a agreement made that the media companies would take on the punishment if the charges were dropped against individual journalists. So,
but Leah, just on that,
yes.
But weren't we saying before that no matter what the journalist is reporting, it still has to go through a sub-editor and an editor? So are you saying, let's say, with the George Pell front page with the Herald Sun, that that got through not only the journalist but the sub-editor and the editor?
So the judgment in the contempt matter was actually really interesting in the fact that the judge noted that none of the court reporters were actually involved in this story. It was a decision made by other journalists and editors in the organization rather than a story that was put forward by the court reporters against the suppression order. So this is a situation where that editorial process is really shown in contrast to what the individual court reporters would have reported.
I must admit, in police circles, we used to believe that suppression orders were given out far too easily. I think they have, and I think they probably were years ago, but now I think it's a lot stricter as to when a suppression order can be made. Would you agree that they used to be very there used to be a lot more, and now I think there isn't?
There's certainly an argument to say, and I think it was particularly in Victoria that criticisms were made of the tendency of magistrates and judges to impose suppression orders. There was an argument to say that courts were being too conservative or too cautious and imposing suppression orders in a way that potentially tilted the balance more towards the protection of proceedings and away from open justice in situations where that wasn't necessarily justified. I'm not sure we can say broadly that there are too many suppression orders, because also we don't necessarily know the extent of suppression orders. But what we can say in individual cases is there an appropriate justification here for the protection either of a vulnerable person? So we often see suppression orders in relation to people who have suffered sexual offences. The victims of those crimes often are not named unless they choose to be, because of the kind of stigma that's attached to that or the extra harm that they might experience if they are publicly known as a person who was sexually assaulted or that kind of thing. We see suppression orders often in cases where there are children involved, so that those children, when they grow up, can hopefully move on or live a life that is not clouded or overhung by the fact that everybody knows that they were the child who was the victim of X crime as they go forward. But there is a argument in high-profile cases, so a case like the Pell case, to say, or the Adrian Bailey cases even, to say, well, were these cases where suppression orders were appropriate? And in some cases, I would say that reasonable minds would differ as to whether those suppression orders were justified or not. The fact that we now have media with a global reach, and social media in particular, means that even though Australian media organisations couldn't report on those cases, media organisations based in other countries could, or people on social media could. So if you wanted to find out the information, you really could find out that information, and it wouldn't be necessarily that hard to do it, which is where that notion that suppression orders are being frustrated by media comes in. But I think suppression orders do really serve an important role, particularly if the reporting on the case before it comes to trial has been really extensive. The suppression order is trying to just dampen down that media coverage a bit in order to protect the fairness of the trial on a whole range of levels.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think, you know, they are an important part of the criminal justice system because they do make sure that the trial or whatever it is being reported, it is all about procedural fairness, whether that be to the accused, to the victim, to a witness. That's the basis, isn't it, of our criminal justice system is procedural fairness.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it's in the interest of society and the victims too that we don't have a trial that is appealed or a trial that has to be discontinued at some point because there has been excessive prejudice experienced by the accused. You know, just because procedural fairness, I suppose, cuts both ways in the sense that as long as the accused gets a fair trial, then we can understand that there's a level of, justice achieved for the victim and for society. But if a trial falls over because of that extreme prejudice, then society and the victim doesn't get that justice.
Well, that's part one, done and dusted. We've got two more weeks of Dr. Williams. What a power of information this woman is. Like, her subject matter is just so thought-provoking. Anyway, next week we talk more about the Kathleen Folbig case and the way women such as Ms. Folbig and Lindy Chamberlain, for instance, were represented in the media and how their behaviour was contrasted against what we might call ideal femininity, you know, like subordinate, nurturing, maternal, calm, etc. They just didn't fit the idea that we have in our minds of what a grieving mother may look like weeping and distraught. I suppose we have such strong images in our mind, don't we, about what a woman should look like or act. That link between their demeanour and assumptions about somebody's credibility or guilt. Dr. Williams discusses a fascinating insight into the psychology that goes on in a trial. And she talks about the trial. She sees it as like a performance, two advocates standing up trying to persuade a jury to believe either one of them. She explains about the psychology of someone just being seated in a dock and how that can persuade some to think, well, if he or she is in the dock, well, they're guilty, or they might be too dangerous to let out of the dock. That's something I hadn't really thought of before. And you may be surprised to know that we talk about podcasts. Who would have thought? And the role that they play or can play in a crime, both the positives and the negatives. We talk quite a bit about The Teacher's Pet and Dr. Williams' view of how that podcast came perilously close to being so prejudicial that it nearly caused the trial not to proceed. Fascinating stuff. Anyway, talk next week. Have a great week. See ya. As you've probably noticed, we've moved to a new platform called Acast. I think that's the right expression, I've got no idea. And my previous reviews haven't transferred over. I need reviews. Could you do me a favour and put up a review? And thank you so much for your support and patronage. With your help, I can give you that little bit extra. Thanks.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.